Iran's Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Vaghifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو تعملون من عمل إلا كنا عليكم شهودا إلا كنا عليكم شهودا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the death toll from Monday's powerful earthquakes in Turkey and Syria passes 8,300 as search and rescue operations continue. An extremist Israeli minister pushes for a five-fold increase in gun permits for settlers as the regime escalates its bloody crackdown on Palestinians. And Russia says it may expel American diplomats if the U.S. embassy in Moscow does not stop spreading, quote, fake news about the war in Ukraine. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has declared a three-month state of emergency in the 10 worst-hit cities after Monday's earthquakes devastated southern Turkey and northern Syria.
Ensure that search and rescue operations and the works in the aftermath are carried out quickly, we have decided to declare a state of emergency based on Article 119 of the Constitution. We will complete the processes rapidly in the Presidency and Parliament with regard to this decision taken for the 10 cities that suffered from the earthquake, and it lasts for 3 months.
Erdogan also unveiled a plan to send over 50,000 aid workers to what he called a disaster zone. The announcement came as the death toll from the two earthquakes measuring 7.8 and 7.5 on the Richter scale keeps rising. Over 8,300 people have died in both countries. Rescuers are racing against time and brave extreme weather to find possible survivors. The World Health Organization has warned that up to 23 million people could be affected by the earthquakes in Syria and Turkey.
Potentially 23 million people are exposed, including around 5 million vulnerable populations, including more than 350,000 older people, 1.4 million children. Civilian infrastructure and potentially health infrastructure have been damaged across the affected region, mainly in Turkey and northwest Syria. Besides massive destruction, the road access in many areas is disrupted inside Turkey and across the border inside northwest Syria.
Well, the WHO said it has mobilized emergency supplies and activated a network of emergency medical teams to provide essential health care for the injured and the most vulnerable. Search and rescue teams have also been dispatched to Turkey and Syria from countries like Germany, Algeria, Mexico, and Italy. Pledges of assistance have been made by many European, Asian, and North American governments. Devastating quakes had their epicenter in southern Turkey, but they also ravaged northern Syria. The affected regions in the two countries have experienced dozens of aftershocks since early Monday. Earlier, we reached out to our correspondent in Istanbul, Roshan Sağlam, to get the latest on the search and rescue operations in the quake-hit Turkish areas.
The rescue missions are still continuing. However, we know that in these disasters, the first 72 hours are very important. And mainly, people can only last under the debris and rubble 72 hours maximum. So we are running out of time. That's why the teams were sent to the disaster area. President Erdogan has called this as the biggest disaster in the era of the Turkish Republic, which is 100 years old. He also said that we have provided 54,000 camps for people who are now without a shelter because the government has forbidden people from going back to their houses in the 10 cities where the earthquakes took place due to the fear of other earthquakes taking place. There are more than 300 aftermath earthquakes that took place, and they are actually strong. The magnitude is between 4.2 till 7.6, which is really a strong a number. It's not easy to control. Also, President Erdogan said that in the coming 3 months, those 10 cities will witness a state of emergency.
Now, countries around the world keep sending aid to the quake-hit areas in Syria and Turkey. Iran has also sent its first batch of aid supplies to Syria. We're now joined by our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, to get the latest about the situation in Syria in the aftermath of this natural disaster. Mohammed, what details do you have to share with us at this point?
Yes, first of all, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the death toll reached 2,500 people killed as a result of this earthquake. Also, hundreds, of course, injured as a result of the collapses that happened following the first major earthquake and the following aftershocks. Now, the search and rescue operations continue, and chances are decreasing, unfortunately, for finding those who might be still alive under the rubble over there. We have teams coming from various countries to help and assist the Syrian government in the search and rescue operations. Syria's prime minister also is touring various areas in the northern parts of Syria and in Latakia, touring the shelter, temporary shelter centers established for those who have become displaced as a result of the collapses. The humanitarian aid continues to arrive into Syria, in various parts of Syria. Airplanes are landing in Damascus International Airport, also in the airports of Aleppo and Latakia, coming from various countries, mainly Iran, Russia. Also, humanitarian assistance is coming from Algeria, Libya, the UAE, and Jordan, including, of course, Iraq. Such humanitarian assistance is very important at such times, and despite the fact that they might be not enough compared to the scale of destruction and efforts needed and the large number of people who have become displaced, but definitely such assistance is very important. Also, very important comments that recently came out from Syria's foreign minister, Dr. Faisal al-Maqdad, in the past 24 hours. He said in a televised interview that all humanitarian assistance is being blocked due to the U.S. sanctions on Syria. And Mr. al-Maqdad said that the U.S. Officials are claiming recently that their sanctions on Syria do not cover humanitarian aid or assistance. And replying to that, Dr. al-Maqdad said that the U.S. sanctions is blocking everything that might come to Syria.
All right, thanks a lot, Mohammed Ali, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Elsewhere, Iran says a report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons that blames Syria for a chemical attack relies on unauthorized sources. Iran's ambassador to the UN said the report by an OPCW-affiliated team is politically motivated and based on an illegal mandate. The report supported by the West blames Syria for an alleged chemical attack on the city of Duma in 2018. Amir Saidi Ravani said Syria's information regarding the use of chemical weapons by terrorists has been disregarded by the organization. He said Western countries are manipulating the OPCW mandate to push their political agenda in Syria. He also slammed such states for ignoring Israel's clandestine weapons of mass destruction program. Israel's hawkish minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, says he will work for a five-fold increase in gun permits for settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Israeli minister has ordered the regime's firearms licensing department to raise the number of monthly permits from about 2,000 to 10,000. Last week, the United Nations warned the move would only lead to more violence and bloodshed in Palestine. Israeli settlers are free to carry pistols across the occupied territories. Recently, regime troops shot and killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy in a raid on the West Bank city of Nablus. The United Nations says the year 2022 was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years. And Israel says it will not stop its settlement expansion, even though its main ally, Washington, has been pressing the regime to do so. Minister Bezalel Smotrich said there would be no construction freeze in the occupied West Bank. Last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken publicly called for an end to the settlement expansion during his meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Blinken also asked Israel to halt demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. Netanyahu has pushed for settlement expansion since he once again became Israel's prime minister. The settlements in the West Bank and Al-Quds are illegal under international law. A number of exiled Bahraini political activists have gathered at a conference in London to mark the upcoming anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising against the kingdom's ruling Al-Khalifa regime. UK politicians present at the event also called on the British government to stop supporting the Persian Gulf monarchy. Our correspondent Said Puruza has more for us.
A conference near the UK Houses of Parliament to mark the 12th anniversary of the Bahraini people's uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands, socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes. For a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil, economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Said Puruza, London.
Russia says the U.S. embassy in Moscow is spreading fake news about the war in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it will expel U.S. diplomats involved in subversive activities. The official note sent to the U.S. embassy also accuses the diplomats of making inappropriate statements about the Russian leadership. The Foreign Ministry has warned the U.S. ambassador to adhere to Russian law when making statements about Russia's armed forces in Ukraine. This says relations between Moscow and Washington are close to an all-time low. The United States is Ukraine's biggest Western supporter. Washington has supplied Kiev with modern weaponry and imposed new economic sanctions on Moscow. Denmark, Germany, and the Netherlands will restore at least 100 Leopard 1 tanks from industry stocks and supply them to Ukraine. Ukraine's armed forces will also receive training, logistical support, spare parts, and an ammunition package within the coming months. Last month, Berlin finally agreed to send the German-made tanks to Ukraine following weeks of pressure from Kiev and its allies. The war in Ukraine began on the 24th of February 2022. Since then, Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against providing military assistance to Ukraine. Moscow says the aid will only prolong the war. And the Arbain pilgrimage is the world's largest religious gathering. It is held in the city of Karbala in Iraq at the end of the 40-day mourning period following the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. While mainstream media prefers to turn a blind eye to this significant annual event, a special international award ceremony has put the spotlight on the ritual and what it stands for. Yusumi Shahmat has more.
Arbain from the eyes of the pilgrims of Imam Hussein's holy shrine. For the eighth consecutive year, the Arbain Walk became the topic of the international artistic event.
This international award is the best way to send the message of Arbain to people across the world, the message of Imam Hussein, who transcends all cultural boundaries.
The gathering honors the world's largest annual pilgrimage held in the city of Karbala in Iraq at the end of the 40-day mourning period following Ashura, the commemoration of the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein.
Imam Hussein is a symbol of universal freedom, compassion, and social justice. We therefore organized the Arbain Award in 2014 with the aim of reflecting the manifestations of the values he stood up and was martyred for.
Artists, filmmakers, photographers, and authors gathered in the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization headquarters in Tehran to take part in the 8th International Arbain Awards ceremony. Participants from 20 countries submitted their works to the ICRO in the fields of photography, videos, travel logs, books, and social media. The works depict a ritual that has been described as an overwhelmingly powerful display of Muslim solidarity. And the 8th International Arbain Awards named this year's winners.
I won the Best Photograph Award. I never thought I would. I just took these pictures during the walk because I felt that I had to capture the moment.
The leader Ayatollah Khamenei says we cannot deliver the true meaning of Arbain unless we express it in some kind of artistic form. And I'm glad that I have done my part and that my travel log won first prize.
I won the first prize in the documentary section, but what I would like to point out is that I'm certain the day will come when Al-Quds is free and we will make documentaries there.
Art is something which is very important in human life, whereby art is something that conveys the message even to those people who cannot go to Karbala, especially when look at people who are staying in countries, for example, from Africa. They don't have the chance to travel to Karbala to see what's happening there. But when they see the art and the exhibition, they try to understand what's going on. You know, they try to imagine. So it gives the clear imagination about what's going on.
When words fail to convey the grandeur of a concept, art communicates the message.
Art transcends all boundaries, and therefore the organizers are saying this is more than just a simple award ceremony to cherish Imam Hussein. It is a way to send his message worldwide. Yusumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
That's a wrap for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
The 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the rising status of women after the Islamic Revolution. The Islamic Revolution in Iran has had considerable achievements in many fields, including with regards to women. In this program, we examine the rising status of Iranian women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Please stay with us. Thank you. Because of the importance of women in society and in social contexts, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have orchestrated propaganda campaigns against the Islamic Republic, focusing in particular on the role of women and trying to belittle their role in the Islamic Republic. Despite this propaganda campaign, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has clearly stated that, "With regards to women, we claim the moral high ground, and we challenge and we question how the West treats women. Women are systematically exploited in Western societies. Women are mistreated and belittled in the West. They are treated as objects and their status is low." One of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution has been the solving of the conundrum of how not to limit and exploit women. In the Pahlavi era, during the reigns of the first and second Pahlavi monarchs, one of the most common problems faced by working women, especially Muslim women in Iran, was how to safeguard and preserve their dignity and status in different social contexts and as working women. Sadly, the monarchs and the ruling elite supported the Western viewpoint with regards to exploitation of women. But after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, women played a full role in the social, cultural, scientific, industrial, and sporting arenas, with their dignity and status safeguarded by the laws of the land. Another achievement of the Islamic Revolution was the presentation of clear role models for Iranian women. Before the revolution, in the Pahlavi era, the regime sought to supplant religion and religious values with a hodgepodge, a confused mixture of ideas drawn from ancient Iranian history and Western values. This strategy, of course, did not work, since it did not correspond to the reality of Iranian society. Iranian women had no successful role models to emulate, either in the context of the West or in the context of ancient Iranian history. Gradually, an identity crisis developed in the country. But after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, successful role models such as Prophet Muhammad's daughter, Hazrat Fatimah Zahra, peace be upon her, and Prophet Muhammad's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, were presented to Iranian women. The status of Iranian women rose after the Islamic Revolution, and deservedly so. About 70 years ago, the French existentialist philosopher, writer, social theorist, and feminist activist Simone Lucie Ernestine de Beauvoir published her famous book, The Second Sex. The book is said to mark the beginning of the second wave of feminism in the West. In her book, Simone de Beauvoir argues that throughout history, women have become classified as the other, which has allowed women to remain oppressed. She advocates for their liberation. Her book, The Second Sex, is a 1,000-page critique of the patriarchal Western society and the idea that women were considered to be lesser beings than men. Simone de Beauvoir famously writes, "One is not born a woman, but becomes one in Western society," suggesting that gender is a societal construct and not a biological identifier. Throughout The Second Sex, her famous book, Simone de Beauvoir references ancient creation myths and the Bible, arguing that women are labelled as the other and thought to be secondary to men. She argues men defined women as the other, the darker, inferior side of humanity, unworthy of responsibility. In order to rectify this shortcoming, de Beauvoir questions the whole concept of sexuality and gender. A very similar point of view about women was held by the ruling elite in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. But after the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, women were viewed not as the second sex or the inferior sex, but rather as delicate human beings and as equals to men in all social fields. Thus, women are regarded as equal to men and play their rightful role in Islamic Iran on a par with men. Official statistics show that before the Islamic Revolution, 35% of Iranian women were literate, that is, they were able to read and write, and 29% of university students were female. About 37% of school pupils were girls. These figures were greatly improved with the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Today, 99.3% of Iranian women are literate, and 60% of Iranian university students are female. Today, 43% of Iranian civil servants are female. Women make up 43% of employees in the government sector. From a total of 2.4 million jobs in the government-owned sector in Iran, 1.1 million jobs are filled by women. Clearly, the huge increase in the number of women university graduates in Iran has had a considerable impact on Iran's economy, with many top jobs in Iranian industry, academia, and business now being occupied by women. Iranian women were given the right to vote in 1962, but before the Islamic Revolution, few women exercised this right and their participation in elections, for example, parliamentary elections, was very limited. But today, about 17% of those who have been elected to the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, are women, and the average participation of women in presidential, parliamentary and local elections in Iran is about 55.9%, a very respectable figure. In his recent meeting with women from all walks of life, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, emphasized that today women can be seen among top Iranian industrialists, top Iranian scientists, engineers, researchers, professors, doctors and surgeons, whereas before the Islamic Revolution, only a handful of such women existed. The leader poignantly added, "All this progress has occurred after the Islamic Revolution. The status of women has gone up tremendously, and we see huge numbers of successful women in business, academia and industry. In sports too, about 16,100 sporting clubs are active specifically for women in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iranian women have managed to win a total of 3,302 medals in various sporting events post-Islamic Revolution. 51 women have been elected or appointed as the head or deputy head of sporting federations in Iran, and 70 women have headed sporting delegations at the provincial level. This is quite an achievement for Iranian women.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Revolution of 79. Part 2.
That the Americans didn't learn about it.
Because there was an unwritten...
The Shahs...
That also talked to a number of people.
On March 2nd, 1974, the Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, was formed at the Shah's instance. All legal parties and trade unions had to be merged into it. Soon after, membership in the party became mandatory. In one of his speeches, the Shah noted, "All people are required to join the party if they want to show their good faith to the throne. Otherwise, they have to leave the country. And if they don't leave the country, they will be sent to prison." The regime announced that passports would be issued for those not interested in the party. Mahmoud Jafarian, the vice president of Rastakhiz Party, who was once involved in communist activities, said, "It doesn't make any difference to be leftist or rightist if you're going to be disloyal to your country."
Shah seemed to be reasonably in control. He had started a new political system there called the Rastakhiz, or Resurgence Party. The idea was you'd have one party, but different views could be expressed in the party.
The revolution was still in its early stages, and the authorities attacked religious and secular opponents on every occasion. But taking down the opposition groups got the regime really in trouble.
Shah was immensely unpopular within the Iranian, within Iran. He was sick. He was dying of cancer. He wasn't at the end of he didn't have perhaps all his faculties. The way he governed law with everything centralized control. So if anything happened to him, the government was paralyzed to do anything. I think he was he had serious problems no matter what happened. His son was in no shape to take over after him, nor did the Iranian people really want that, I think. I think it was a popular revolt.
I've read Professor Zoe's book, and I think it's a fascinating psychological portrait. But I've also talked to a number of people who dealt with the Shah, Iranians and American government officials. And their experience was of an extremely arrogant figure who simply did not brook any kind of opposition whatsoever, and was in control of every meeting that he walked into. I don't know how to reconcile these images, and it's certainly possible that this forceful, proud presentation might have crumbled in the face of unprecedented popular unrest, in the face of his own illness, of course, having been diagnosed with cancer.
In November 1977, the Shah made a visit to the United States. The police had to use tear gas to disperse anti-Shah protesters during President Carter's speech in front of the White House. The media captured the Shah and the president shedding tears, a scene many revolutionary groups liked. During the visit, Carter fully supported the Shah, and the Shah announced his agreement on fixing the price of oil.
To make decisions himself based on no knowledge of anything. How serious he was and what would that have actually happened, it's hard to say. It's clear that he, he was not friendly toward the Shah. In fact, he refused him admission to the United States even to seek medical treatment. Whether the U.S. would have ceased arms sales to any dictatorship probably would not have happened, since there are so many and they depend on, the U.S. depends heavily on arms sales. But who knows? Esperzynski.
Well, that would be a very...
We have to announce it on the air so it doesn't look peculiar. Your Majesty, are you being sold weapons in the United States in part so that you can defend our point of view?
Well, I can't really see what that means. But if you say that we are allies, I can say yes, we are allies.
In his official visit to Iran, President Carter of the United States said, The military alliance between Iran and America is indestructible. Just a week later, Etelaat newspaper published an insult to Ayatollah Khomeini in an article by Ahmad Rashidi Mutlaq. The article hurt public feelings and rocked the country. The epicenter was the city of Qom.
One of the most staggering things to me about the revolution and the American attitude to the revolution was the failure of American policymakers to understand just how weak the Shah of Iran was. I'm not talking about weak militarily or weak in the sense of not having a good police force. I'm talking about weak in terms of a character structure. Let me give you an example. So Jimmy Carter is the president of the United States. And Jimmy Carter thinks that the Shah of Iran is really a tough guy. And so how are we going to deal with this really tough guy? I mean, how do you deal with a guy who's, you know, walking around with these medals, right? How do you deal with a tough guy? Well, the United States has this ambassador in the Philippines. And this ambassador in the Philippines, William Sullivan, he's been dealing with Marcos, and he's been doing a great job, and everybody knows Marcos is really a tough dude. So let's send Sullivan from the Philippines to Tehran because he knows how to handle tough guys. We don't have anybody else who's as good with tough guys. So Sullivan, who doesn't know anything about the Middle East, who doesn't know anything about Iran, and he admits this. He wrote a book, and he says this in his book. Didn't know anything about Iran. He had never served in the Middle East. He had always been out there in Asia. He shows up in Tehran. Now, what was the style with which American ambassadors dealt with the Shah? This was the style. American ambassador would go to see the Shah once a week. There was always a fixed time for a meeting. And the Shah would welcome him and the Shah, and they'd chat a little bit of small talk. And then the Shah would say, I have come up with this brilliant plan for the future of my country. We are going to build a superhighway from Tehran to Mashhad, all the way across northern Tehran. And it's going to cost us such and such, and it'll take so long to build this, and that's what's going to happen. And the American ambassador would say something like, Your Majesty, this is a brilliant plan. Only you could have thought up the strategy for making your country prosperous. It's going to be great. But I have one slight suggestion. Maybe instead of building the superhighway, you should pave some roads from the villages to the main road so that farmers could get their crops out to market, and that would increase the income of the poor villagers. And the Shah would say, exactly what I was thinking. This was what I was going to do. That's it. And so then the Shah would go out and make some roads from the villages to the main roads. Well, that was the way the Americans tried to influence the Shah's behavior. And everybody understood this was Sullivan comes to Tehran. And he tells us in his book. And he sits down with the Shah for the first interview. And the Shah says, Ambassador Sullivan, this is what I think I'm going to do. And he gives this whole thing. And Ambassador Sullivan looks at him and he says, Majesty, you're the Shah. Whatever you think is right, that's what you should do. The Shah was stunned. What do you think the Shah heard when Ambassador Sullivan said, you're the Shah, whatever you want to do is you should do? Sullivan was being honest. He didn't know what the hell to do in Iran because he didn't know anything about Iran. And he figured the Shah's a tough guy. He had been there for a long time. If that's what Shah thought was right, that's what he should do. The Shah didn't hear that. What the Shah heard was, you should do whatever you want to do, meaning the government of the United States doesn't care what you do. We don't give a damn. You do whatever you want to do, meaning we don't care about you anymore. The Shah was devastated.
Opinion is divided as to whether the Shah was conscious of his illness. But one thing is for sure. During the last years of his reign, the Shah was always in two minds, unable to make right decisions. What's more was that he was half afraid that the Americans would take him off the throne if they knew about his illness. In the spring of 1978, political prisoners in Qasr prison went on a hunger strike. As the new Iranian year of 1357 came in, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a proclamation paying tribute to Tabriz martyrs and attacking the United States of America. He said, "The U.S. is the root cause of the hardship we're suffering because it supports the despotic Shah." The Shah had kept his cancer secret, even from his nearest and dearest. But the symptoms of the disease were undeniable. The Shah's inability to make decisions was one.
The Shah was ill. We did not know the Shah was ill. In fact, I've got a thing going with Gary Sick. I learned from a very good source that the Americans didn't learn about it until October. Now, Sick, who was the White House National Security Council person, says that, no, they never didn't hear about it till then. They didn't hear about it till almost 6 months later. Clearly, if we had known the Shah was ill, we would have seen the problem not as one of political adjustment, but of regime survival, and we would have, everybody would have behaved differently in that case.
There were rumors that the Shah was not well, but even after he left the country, he had pictures of him playing tennis. He was a man who was very fit, and he gave the impression of being in perfectly good health. And truly, we didn't know about it. And there are lots of people who say, oh, you must have known. Well, we didn't. It actually would have made a huge difference. And the fact is, the Shah fully understood that if people knew that he had cancer, they would change their policy toward Iran because they would know that he wasn't going to be there in a few years. So they would change their policy. And it's true. But in fact, the CIA formally concluded in August of 1978 that the Shah of Iran was in no serious trouble and that he would be around for many years to come, for the next 5 to 10 years.
If we had known something about his condition, we could have gone to him and said, look, you know, we're talking about regime survival here. Do you want your son to be slaughtered in the streets after you're gone? Well, then maybe we better. So I told Charlie Noss I could even write that set of talking point.
Then you mentioned.
But nobody thought the unthinkable until it was too late. You know, absolutely committed to the Shah, at least through the Jalé Square riots, either in my or one of the other cities about the time is that. Before the Shah moved the Jalé Square riders, he wanted to know if it was all right with the America, if it was okay with the Americans. And Brzezinski told him on the telephone, it's a problem of order. Of course, we would be behind you if you do that. And then I learned from my Iranian friends later that some said, well, the Shah didn't really believe him. He says, yeah, we'll go around and kill him, and then we'll take the heat later. As Marvin Zonas says, he had no balls.
On April 14th, 1978, Asadullah Alam died from cancer in New York City. The Shah lost his chief advisor.
Remember that the pillar of the regime, the really tough guy who really helped the Shah to be strong and as tough as he needed to be. And I think we have to be very sympathetic here. It was not easy to be the Shah of Iran. And the Shah, who was a weak character, found it especially difficult to be the Shah of Iran, which is what's wrong with hereditary monarchies. I mean, his father was a real tough guy. The Shah wasn't a tough guy. So who was the guy that made him tough? Asadullah Alam, his boyhood friend, the guy who was prime minister when I first arrived in Iran, and Khomeini was arrested, and the Shahs didn't know what to do, and Alam said to the Shah, go out and shoot these guys, and you'll stay in power, and he did it. Alam died of cancer just before the Iranian Revolution began. So the Shah lost a tremendously important advisor.
As the revolution gained momentum in Iran, the Shah blamed the U.S. for withdrawing its support, having no idea how influential the clergy were in leading the revolution. Meanwhile, Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State, came to Iran to meet with the Shah. But neither the Americans nor the Shah's men had a finger on the pulse of the revolution. Barking on the wrong tree, they had been focusing their attention just on leftist forces for several years. There is no doubt that Ayatollah Khomeini was successful in extending his influence over the whole Middle East, and not just Iran. As an Iranian religious scholar and political leader, he managed to make his country the world's first Islamic republic. Being an outspoken critic of the regime, Ayatollah Khomeini used to denounce the Shah's programs. In a proclamation issued by him and undersigned by 8 senior Islamic scholars, the Ayatollah specified the Shah's violations of the Iranian constitution and condemned him for corrupting public morals and kowtowing to the US and Israel. On the dawn of November 4, 1964, the Shah's commandos surrounded Ayatollah Khomeini's house in Qom. They arrested him and took him directly to Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. Soon after, he was flown out of Iran to Turkey. Out of sight, out of mind. That was the rationale behind his exile. The stay in Turkey was not congenial, for Turkish law didn't allow Ayatollah Khomeini to wear the cloak and turban of the Muslim scholar. September 5, 1965, he left Turkey for Najaf in Iraq, where he would stay for 13 years. On October 23, 1977, Mustafa Khomeini, the Ayatollah's son, passed away in Najaf. Defending national independence, Ayatollah Khomeini chastised the Shah's regime, saying, "We witnessed that while Muslims were in war with Israeli forces, Iran's government recognized the Israeli state on the Shah's orders." In 1978, mass protests were organized to support Ayatollah Khomeini. The regime, as usual, responded with an iron fist. Alarm bells had started to ring.
I don't think on the part of official Washington there ever was much understanding of the Ayatollah. There were some few academics who had tracked his sermons, were aware of his views from for those years he was in exile in Iraq, and then that sudden appearance in the Paris suburbs. It didn't really penetrate official thinking in Washington, who he was, what he was. I mean, the Shah knew him as an enemy, and that was, I think that was it, black and white enemy.
Ayatollah Khomeini was in the neighboring country of Iraq, and it was too close for comfort. At the Shah's instance, the Iraqi regime asked the Ayatollah to give up his political activities, otherwise he had to leave the country. In October 1978, Ayatollah Khomeini flew from Iraq to a new exile in a suburb of Paris. By that time, the Ayatollah had developed an international reputation as the spiritual and political leader of the Iranian Revolution. Being thousands of kilometers away from his homeland, Ayatollah Khomeini set the course of the revolution, urging Iranians not to compromise and ordering work stoppages against the regime. During the last few months of his exile, the Ayatollah received a constant stream of reporters, supporters, and notable personalities, all eager to hear the leader of the revolution speak.
In the limelight.
A catastrophic earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed at least 4,300 people. Dozens of countries have offered help as rescue workers and residents frantically search for survivors after a devastating 7.8 magnitude tremor hit Turkey and Syria. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. International rescue missions were rushing to Turkey and Syria on Monday, 6th of February 2023, after one of the most powerful earthquakes to hit the region in at least a century left more than 4,300 people dead, with thousands more injured and an unknown number trapped in the rubble. The early morning earthquake and dozens of aftershocks wiped out entire apartment blocks in Turkey and heaped more destruction on the Syrian community living in Turkey. Pledges of emergency assistance to both countries have poured in from across the globe. The magnitude 7.8 earthquake, which hit in the darkness of a winter morning, was followed by a second 7.5 magnitude earthquake in the middle of the day on Monday, 6th of February, as rescuers in both countries were still attempting to search for survivors. By the early evening on Monday, the death toll in Turkey stood at 2,921. The country's emergency services had declared, and more than 14,483 people were recorded as injured. Yunus Sezer, who heads Turkey's disaster relief agency, AFAD, said nearly 15,000 search and rescue personnel had been deployed to the regions of southern Turkey which had been hit by earthquake. At least 1,444 people were killed in Syria, according to figures from the Syrian government. Rescue workers in the northwestern regions of Syria are still busy searching for survivors. The toll of 3,823 is expected to rise as rescue workers and residents search frantically for survivors under the rubble of crushed buildings in cities on both sides of the border between Turkey and Syria. The earthquake struck at 4:17 a.m. in the early hours of the morning local time at a depth of about 18 kilometers near the Turkish city of Gaziantep, which is home to about 2 million people. "Can you hear me?" rescuers shouted as they searched in the province of Kahramanmaras, the epicenter of the earthquake. In some places around southeastern Turkey, survivors could be heard screaming from beneath collapsed buildings, according to an Associated Press report. Television images from Turkey showed shocked people standing in snow in their clothes, watching rescuers dig through the debris of damaged homes. Buildings were leveled while many people were still asleep in the early hours of the morning. Tremors were felt as far away as Lebanon, Greece, Iraq, and the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean. Turkey is one of the world's most active earthquake zones, with land stretching over the Anatolian fault line in the north of the country that has caused large and destructive tremors. Izmir and the surrounding Kocaeli region, close to Istanbul, were rocked by a 7.4 magnitude earthquake in 1999, the worst to hit Turkey in decades. That earthquake killed more than 17,000 people, including at least 1,000 people in Istanbul, amid widespread destruction. In Gaziantep, 150 miles from the border with Syria and 50 miles from the earthquake's epicenter in Kahramanmaras, residents were woken on Monday by violent shaking. "We woke up with a jolt as the electricity was turned off. We laid still and waited for the earthquake to finish. Our houses were full of broken glass," said Sinan Shahan, a tradesperson in Gaziantep, Turkey. Shahan added, "We used our phone's flashlight so we could get dressed and hurried out of the house. Anyone able to save themselves has now fled somewhere." He said, "I was in Istanbul when the big earthquake hit in 1999. This was much more severe than that." Images from Gaziantep appeared to show that the earthquake caused the collapse of the city's historic castle, an ancient and imposing stone structure built atop a hill used as an observation point in ancient times. The head of the Turkish Red Crescent Society, the biggest humanitarian organization in Turkey and part of the International Red Cross, said the group had mobilized resources for the region and urged people to evacuate their damaged homes. Images on Turkish television showed rescuers digging through the rubble of leveled buildings in the city of Kahramanmaraş and neighboring Gaziantep, where entire high-rise blocks were destroyed. Buildings also crumbled in the city of Adıyaman, Malatya, and Diyarbakir, where people rushed out onto the streets in panic. In Syria, the Syrian Health Ministry reported damage across the provinces, the northern provinces of Aleppo, Latakia, Hama, and Tartus, and also on Syria's Mediterranean coast. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is overseeing the disaster relief efforts in his country. And there's also an election in Turkey, which is due on 14th of May.